This is Games as a Podcast, hosted by Chris and Ethan. We're two Sega alums that love talking about the past, present, and future of games, and the industry that makes them. Each week, we explore a gaming topic,
often mixing in our perspectives from our time at Big Blue and beyond. And some weeks, we'll have a guest, usually someone whose career has crossed ours. We talk about their own experiences and perspectives as well.
Today, we are joined by Mr. Mike Gallo, and we have known Mike for years, Sega for life. Mike, it is great to see you and speak with you today. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Hi, guys. Thanks, Chris. It's great to be chatting with you guys. It's been way too long since we last spoke. I have been around in gaming since the late 80s. I started at NEC TurboGrafx, was what they call a game counselor, which was effectively just someone that you would call in for a helpline, and we would help you get through the games, beat bosses, give you secrets, stuff like that.
I thought you said beat boxes.
No, we did that too, but that was special service. Yeah, and then that was kind of just the beginning, and one of the guys that worked at Konami or at Turbo left to go to Konami, called me up because they had a position open for a beta tester, which was just effectively QA at the time. So that's what I left after a couple of years and went there. Konami was a whole other ball game because it was much more involved with game development, working with a lot of the teams that we had contracted with in the US, but also, of course, dealing with all of the teams from Japan and working on everything from Commodore 64 games all the way up through the latest stuff, which was at the time was Super Nintendo.
Awesome. Such a storied history, and really look forward to tucking in a bit and hearing some awesome stories. But first, we are going to go to our little segment called Quick Hit, where Ethan regales us with his tales of adventures in all the new games that he's bought for the week. Ethan, how are you?
Good. Very good, but not quite as good as I would have hoped at this time, because the game I've been most looking forward to, I would say all year, is the new Zelda game. And while it's creative and beautiful and fun, it's not the A+, at least in my opinion, that I hoped it would be. So Quick Hit.
Bomber.
Absolutely creative approach to combining different solutions for puzzle solving. But you are playing a character who effectively does not have a sword in a Zelda game. And that simple change makes it less fun for me. Combine that with the fact that when you're solving puzzles, you get so many different options for trying to do it your own way that you find that it's just this kind of decision paralysis, where instead of knowing that there's three or four different components that you need to put together the right way to beat the boss, you're looking at potentially 32 different solutions, and some of them are useless, and you have to kind of sort your way through which one actually will do the trick, because you're
so it's like a sandbox puzzler kind of thing?
Yes. And the downside to that is just that you don't have this feeling of I'm doing it right. I often get the feeling like I'm barely doing it, and there's probably some better way to do it, but I don't want to have to sift through this enormous number of options to try to figure out which is the best one.
Well, is there a best one, or is it just the min-maxer and you just gets annoyed because you're like, I know there's a better way to do this and I just don't know what it is?
Well, I'll tell you this. I figured out ways to do it, but unfortunately, they just weren't that fun to execute. And I guess that's the problem, right?
Okay.
So like barely chipping away health on a boss using things that I've picked up in the environment and just wishing that I was having more fun doing it, knowing that probably there is some super cool way to do it, but it just doesn't telegraph well enough. So there's also there's also a lot of slowdown in this game. So if you played the remake of the Game Boy game, Link's Awakening, It's the same development team, and that game also had slowdown. It's present here as well. So it really feels like something that probably would run better on whatever the Switch 2 ends up being. Mm-hmm. On top of that, it just, again, it's trying to do something totally new, which I really admire, but it just feels cumbersome. And I also just want to be able to beat down enemies with swords, which is barely a factor here. It's just effectively not a meaningful part of the game. So I'd say it's a solid B. Mm-hmm. That would be great in most cases, except Zelda games are usually A pluses. So that's my minor disappointment this week.
Important question. If there's no sword, how do I destroy grass to get hearts and coins?
You spin your wand around. And so, yeah, they have an alternative to that. But it doesn't do damage to enemies, just to grass. So
that's a weed whacker wand.
Yeah, I'm sure people will disagree with me. We'd love to hear it, but I was a little disappointed. The one that surprised me, though, was Epic Mickey Rebrushed. I was surprised both by how nicely they have adjusted things that have been fundamentally problematic with this game since it came out on the Wii, I believe, in 2011. And most of that is down to camera control. Now they actually take full advantage of two analog sticks, and that feels great. It's still this wildly creative thing. It's Warren Spector, the guy who did Deus Ex, who just said, hey, I want to do Mickey Mouse, and came up with a really elaborate set of mechanics that involve paint and, you know, adding paint or thinner to change environments. Super, super cool. Some kind of long load times, which is a bummer, and kind of crazy price point. It's $60 for this update. But if you're...
It's a spicy meatball.
Right. If you're not put off by that, it's definitely worth playing. And I am glad that I picked it up on the Switch, because when you're aiming your thinner or paint, you're able to, either with the Pro Controller or the Joy-Cons, just tilt the device to get exactly the aiming that you want. So it kind of nicely emulates the thing that was novel with the Wii version to begin with. So
that's a nice touch.
Yeah, some nice care put into that particular port. So a lot of Switch play this week. And, you know, I'd say if you were choosing between the two of them, Zelda probably overall is the better package. But, you know, they're both kind of in the B to B plus range, and they're both worth playing.
Not shabby at all. Thanks, Ethan.
Yep.
Speaking of classic games, Mike, you have been in games for a number of years, and you've worked on games that are now considered classics. I have very fond memories of playing Contra 3 Alien Wars on my SNES Super Nintendo, but I would love to hear for you, what was it like working at Konami back in the day?
Well, back in the early 90s, the Super Nintendo stuff was great, because like getting to see those games in progress and get a debug build of Castlevania or Contra and being able to just go through and level select and take a look at everything that was going on, like that type of stuff, as you're just getting into game development, that is, and if you really enjoy games, it's a very nerdy, geeky thing to be able to experience of like, oh, let's go check this out. And you'll find like these random, you know, I couldn't even tell you how much stuff we were able to see that never made it into the final game, because, you know, they would have a lot of things in the level select that you could load into. And it's like, oh, that's, you know, it was just a test. They were playing around.
It is like the secret master code that you get. It's just mind-blowing, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, I remember both Contra 3 and Castlevania 4 loading into some of those levels that were using some of the Mode 7 effects and seeing that stuff for the first time. And, like, we would have some of the guys from marketing would come over and some of the guys from sales would come over. I had this big central cube area because I had to have so much hardware set up because part of what I did was test master discs and things like that. So I had every PC, Tandy, Commodore, Amiga, all this stuff set up in this cube area.
Wow.
So whenever we got something new in, one of my colleagues who was from the Japan office, he would be the one that was the main conduit for communications back and forth. And he would be like, we got a package today, let's take a look. And we would, you know, oh, hey, it's a Super Nintendo game. And, you know, when people would gather and we would check it out and be like, oh, it's the new Castlevania build or whatever. And there was a lot of excitement around that stuff, just kind of on a daily or weekly basis. We'd get these packages in not knowing what was coming. But there was always something cool like that. When
you say packages, do you mean literal stuff in the mail?
Like literal FedEx package. Like it was literally a FedEx package. We also had... The other thing that just sounds so archaic at this point was we had a nightly fax. So we would, in the morning, we would come in and everybody would get a copy of the fax from headquarters. And there would be a lot of things in there. You know, you'd read through and be like, oh, this is for me to answer. This is for me to answer. We'd have like a little a little meeting in the morning and just be like, okay, Mike, you're going to answer that, or whoever. And then we'd have to go to this green screen terminal, of which there were two of them in the whole office, for all employees, write our response and send it in. And then that would get faxed out. And that was literally how our communication happened every night. So there was no, like, we didn't get email until well into my career at Konami. So that was really wild stuff. And then thinking back about it, it's just like, wow, how did we do business? All of my bugs were handwritten, and then the executive assistant would help type them up at nighttime. So
in Japanese?
No. This was just if I was writing up bugs for our U.S. developers. We worked with a bunch of U.S. teams. And for the nightly fax for Japan, I would just go and type that stuff up and put it in the database.
So in terms of the development, how much of the development was being done in the U.S. versus development in Japan that was coming over for you to localize?
Yeah, initially very little. Especially
very little
in the US, sorry. Gotcha. Especially for consoles, right? Like the most of the console development that we were working on was all from Japan. Eventually we did have US based teams that spun up in our office, and that was right around the cusp of, it was still Genesis, Super Nintendo, Sega CD, and then like just on the cusp of like PlayStation 1 development times. And in addition to that, we had some external partners that we had. So one of the biggest ones when I first started there was DSI Canada, was doing a bunch of PC development for Konami. They had a huge contract with them for a number of games because Konami really wanted to get into PC development. And DSI Canada eventually became EA Canada. They eventually got bought by EA. So we were working with them. And I think about some of these moments because, like, we could have worked with DSI Canada. Like, that could have potentially been something that Konami would
been Konami Canada.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, there was also...
What sort of titles did they do?
They were doing PC versions. There was an NFL game that they did. They did a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Manhattan Missions, I think was one of them. I think that might be the NES. There was an NES one, I think.
TMNT 3. That's part 3, yeah.
But there was another PC specific one, and
not a hockey one?
There was not a hockey one. I think that DSI may have done the Bill Elliott NASCAR game.
Well, if I remember correctly, Konami had the NFL license during the SNES era, right?
Yep. Yes, I worked on that game. I worked on the there was a Super Nintendo game and there was a PlayStation game.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. PlayStation game called NFL Full Contact. You've probably never heard of it.
No, I have not heard of it. I also remember playing Konami's, is it International Soccer Superstar?
Yeah, International Superstar Soccer. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
I loved that game.
That was a so great good. Series. Yeah. Really, really good soccer game that it suffered because it didn't have the license. It didn't have FIFA. But
it's amazing that the franchise is still alive in some form with their e-soccer title now, or e-football.
I can't remember exactly what it is. But yeah, there was the Super Nintendo ones and PlayStation versions. And I didn't play. I mean, I left before PS2 era. So I'm sure that it continued on during then. But yeah, there was a lot of, every time we got one of those in, we played a lot of it at the office. I'll tell you that.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Such great gameplay. I think Super Soccer was the first one on the SNES, which I played until the Konami soccer game came out, because it just blew it away.
Yeah. Well, and I got to say, you were there, Mike, at exactly the right time, right? Between SNES and PlayStation 1 for Konami, they were arguably the best third party that existed at that time. Just looking at, Chris was saying he played Contra 3. When I bought my Super Nintendo, I was working at Software Etc. I had saved up my checks, bought that right alongside the machine with Contra 3. Had to have that. Very quickly bought Super Castlevania 4 after that. those games today stand up beautifully. They're super fun to play. Yeah. And then, of course, you look at the PlayStation era and Symphony of the Night. That Castlevania game is in my top 10 of all time. And so is, of course, Metal Gear Solid, the first one. That I remember that one coming out the same Christmas that The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time came out. And that is just one of the most memorable periods of gaming in my life because of those two games.
Yeah. I have a really good story about Symphony of the Night. So back in that era, everyone was really interested in 3D. It was 3D. It's got to be 3D. It's got to be 3D. And, you know, like I had mentioned earlier, we would, whenever a package from Japan would come in with new builds or new games or whatever, a lot of times we wouldn't even know. Like, we would not know that there was a new Castlevania game being worked on. Like, it would be very secret. That changed gradually through the time I was there. But, you know, a lot of times it would be a surprise. So we got in a early version of Symphony of the Night. I don't even remember what the, it might have, I can't remember what the working title of it was. But a lot of folks came in. We had moved and taken over an old storage room. So me and my colleague were sharing this like storage room area. And again, had the sales and marketing guys came over and took a look. And they almost immediately dismissed it because it was 2D. I was just like, they didn't stick around that long. You know, obviously they didn't have time to sit there and mess with it like I did. So throughout the day, I didn't get a chance to play that much during the day, but I would, this is back in the day when I was, you know, 19, 20, whatever. And I would just work until I got tired and then go home. So I remember playing that game that night. And I was probably at the office until almost midnight because there was so much there. And I discovered the upside down castle.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't enough. I didn't have enough time to play through it to that point, but I was using level selects and like just loading up in areas. And it was kind of weird because it would just load in like a checkpoint or whatever it was. I was like, oh, my gosh. I need to get these guys back in. So the next morning when I got in the office, I'm like, guys, you got to come and take a look at this. So had them come back in. I showed them some of it because there's a few of those big bosses in that game that are using some, you know, that are 3D built with, you know, polygons. Oh, my gosh.
Full screen, so
brought them,
too.
Yeah, yeah. Brought them back in.
Oh, the triangles.
Loaded up some of those things. Showed them some of those bosses. Showed him the fact that I didn't really know yet, but I'm like, this is the same boss room, but it's like upside down. Like, I didn't know yet at that point what the upside down castle was. And it wasn't until later that we found out that, you know, oh, you, when you play through, there's a certain point where everything flips and all that stuff. But it was kind of one of those moments where everyone was like, oh, I get it now. And I was pretty happy about that because it was already a great looking thing anyway, even though it was 2D, but it was kind of a tough sell initially for folks. Mm.
That is a very common thing, I would imagine, to experience in offices where you have a mix of people who just deeply love and understand games and people who are, you know, more focused on marketing or other parts of the process. I do remember something very similar at Sega when we were getting Vanquish out the door. And here was a game that a lot of people in the Sega of America offices were saying, this just doesn't look or feel like a Western game. This is something that people are not going to accept. We can't market this properly. And yet the game was brilliant. And I remember Maeda-san just coming to me and saying, please play this and tell me it's great. And I played it and I was overwhelmed with how cool and stylish and unlike for good, right? Something you know, that people weren't paying attention to, like how its unique characteristics made it something special that we really should focus on. And it sounds like it was similar with Symphony of the Night, where people just didn't know what they had their hands on.
You know, it's funny you mention that because I was literally thinking about joining you guys and talking about this in the Sega days, spending some time playing that game or watching people play it in that conference room in the corner at Sega. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that's the one. And it was like, oh, yeah, this is pretty cool. And then you know, I don't know. I wasn't directly working on it at that point. So, but I do remember that whole kind of time frame.
I mean, the game had a button for taking a drag off your cigarette, which had almost no function in the game other than to look cool, right?
Cigarettes are cool, kids. Remember that.
Yeah.
I wonder, and it seems increasingly a fixture of the past. I think gaming appetites are much broader now. I think people are way more willing to check out a title from a specific country or a specific genre just because there's so many more gamers. I think you have a lot bigger audience. Mike, I have a question about just the process at Konami. How did the feedback process work? So you got these builds, you played through them, you checked out the levels. Was your job to, or part of your job to provide kind of notes on them, or what was your role in terms of the development process then?
Yeah, I mean, really what I turned into was, I think it was from a localization standpoint, like if they did not have like a very specific person, we had a great crew that was part of the international business department in Japan. These were all younger folks. They were all really into games. And we had a native English speaker who also was in Japan. He taught English in Japan and was a fluent Japanese speaker. So he was the guy that worked with Kojima and worked on a bunch of the bigger titles, Metal Gear Solid, Silent Hill, Snatcher, those types of things. Like he did a lot of that translation work for those games. I don't want to mention him by name. You should know who he is if you know anything about all this stuff. Only because I don't know. I just feel weird about bringing up someone's name that isn't involved in this at the moment. But he was a great guy and did great stuff on a lot of different games. I was there to help for the games that didn't have that budget, right? The games that didn't have the attention. Suikoden, Vandal Hearts, Mind, as some of those games where they would do the translations from Japanese to English using resources in Japan, but they would always ask us to go through and check it. And check it to the point of sending over the game, like some of the game XML files or wherever they were. I think they were CSVs. Everything was output as CSVs. And go through and do edits live in those game files. So if there's typos in there, it was probably my fault. So, I mean, that was...
You'll never know.
So that was one part of it. The other side of it was they did want our feedback. And it was an interesting, it was an interesting mix because it was, a lot of... There was a lot of resistance very early on when I started there. The Japanese teams really didn't want feedback from the U.S. audience or from the U.S. market.
Familiar.
Yeah, that sounds strangely familiar.
And I mean, I think it's just, it's a bit of a cultural thing and it's a bit of an art thing. Like, I think they're just like, this is our art. This is our vision. This is what we're going to do. But I think that over time, we were able to provide feedback or talk about bugs that we'd found or things like that, that we would send over literally in the nightly fax. We would send over gobs of feedback on some of these builds that we would get. And I think over time, the Japanese team started to see, if there's actually some decent feedback coming in. I'm sure we put a lot of feedback in there that was really poor that they ignored, but I think that we were able to get a little bit of build a little bit of a reputation of being useful in that way.
Yeah, it becomes a relationship, right? You just got to establish some trust, and then you feel like you have more of a voice.
And where it really got solidified was whenever we would have this is CES timeframe, so this is pre E3. The Japanese teams would send a lot of folks over. Usually some of the game directors and the designers and things like that would come over to the U.S. for the Vegas show or for the Chicago show.
Because Vegas?
Sure. But we would always get a chance to sit down and talk with them and, maybe go to dinner or whatever it might be. There's a moment where we were in Vegas and we were able to get a meeting with some of the folks from Japan that were over. and it was the Castlevania team. And it was the team that was starting to work on Bloodlines. But we got to talk with them about the whip and the mechanics of the whip from Super Castlevania 4 and what we really liked about it, what we didn't, and what we thought would be cool to have moving forward. And it was one of those meetings, again, as a fan of video games and working on being able to work in this environment, we left that meeting, me and my colleagues from the U.S. office, and we were like, we just spent like an hour and a half talking about the whip in Castlevania. Like, it was just really cool. It was a great moment. And again, I think that, like you said, building that relationship and that, you know, that kind of back and forth was great.
Well, and Mike, the difference between Super Castlevania 4, which is a masterpiece, and Castlevania Bloodlines on Genesis, which frankly I like even more, part of it is the size of the character. I thought that the character was just too big in Super Castlevania 4 and made it harder to navigate the screen, but like the character felt just right in Bloodlines. And so now the whip, you're saying, like, there was the 360 degree movement that you could do with the whip and being able to swing with the whip on Super Castlevania 4. I do not remember those being part of Bloodlines. So how did that conversation go? Like, what did you want them to do? What did they add? What did they change?
I don't remember all the specific about it. I do remember talking about like the ability to swing, and like you could, one of the cool things in 4, but it really wasn't super useful, is, you know, you could throw your whip out and just hold it there.
Yep.
And then spin it around, and it looked kind of cool. But yeah, I think that the reason for that whole discussion was just they wanted to see what we liked and what we thought was cool. But of course they have a vision for what they want to do, but they also, you know, whatever limitations they might have or whatever, you know, other constraints that they had to deal with. That game, it's really interesting because that game was made in the era of Mortal Kombat and this other stuff that was ultra violent, right?
Yeah.
Or that was ultra violent back then. And I think that was the whole reason for the way the game was named and the dripping blood on the title screen, like all of that stuff was part of that kind of reaction to the violent video game market in the U.S.
Well, I want to also ask about kind of combining two worlds of your past, the TurboGrafx-16 and Konami and Castlevania. Rondo of Blood is arguably the best of them all when it comes to the 16-bit Castlevania games. And yet it took forever for it to finally come to the U.S. It was decades later. Why, if you have any knowledge of it, did it not come out as a TurboGrafx-16 game here in the States? Because it would have been huge, I would think.
I mean, I think at that point, though, Turbo was very much done in the U.S. Mm. It would I even want to say that we talked about Sega CD.
Oh.
Unsubstantiated rumors. I don't know. I can't remember exactly what the conversation was around that. Ethan, we did bring it out in the U.S. It was called Dracula X on the Super Nintendo.
Well, yeah.
Of course, a dramatically different game.
Yes.
Probably one of the least liked of all of those. Well, certainly of the 16-bit Castlevania games.
Yes.
Not the least liked overall, but of the 16-bit era, not very well liked. And I think that at that point, like, it was so late in the cycle for Turbo, and even like Sega CD even was like not, it didn't, couldn't justify it. So I think that, you know, the focus then was like, okay, N64 is coming. I think even Saturn was coming at that. So there was all this other stuff that was on the horizon. Limited resources, sales potential, all of those things is ultimately what doomed that era of getting Rondo of Blood in the U.S.
That makes sense. Well, and if we can skip really quickly, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about what it was like from a standards standpoint getting Metal Gear Solid into the hands of Sony for approval when there was so much fourth wall breaking. Let's think about Psycho Mantis, right? When he's saying, I know you play Castlevania, right? By reading the memory card. Or I can make your controller move, and then you put it down and the rumble makes it actually move on the floor. And of course, the biggest one to me was when at a later point of the game, you're told that the code is on the back of the box, and you physically have to look at the back of your PlayStation 1 box to get that code. How did Sony allow those things, and what kind of a fight was there, if any?
I think that a lot of the groundwork for that was handled on the Japanese side.
Ah, makes sense.
We I don't remember having much of a struggle with that in the US. So I think that, again, a lot of that stuff was sorted out on the Japanese side. And, you know, it is one of those things like, I wish I had those reports. I wish I had those reports back from, you know, when we would submit those builds and get feedback from first parties and get feedback from Sony or Nintendo, because I guarantee there's probably some really interesting tidbits in there of things we had to change.
Yeah.
Like in that case, again, I it does not stand out that there was anything like that for Metal Gear. I think that Sony knew what Metal Gear was going to be for them.
Okay.
In the US. And I'm fairly certain that they had worked through a lot of this stuff on the Japanese side before we ever even saw it in the US. I mean, there's a moment where Psycho Mantis turns your screen goes black.
Right. Yeah.
The Hideo thing, right? Which I'm sure people thought it was a problem the first time they saw it.
I can only imagine, yeah. Well, and then the content was more mature than you'd expect from a PlayStation 1 game. I remember there was a point where Meryl had to hide a key card, and Snake asked, where did you hide it? And she's like, women have more hiding places than men. And I'm like, what? How can you put that in this game? I was very amused, but like, I'm also surprised that kind of thing got through.
Yeah, I mean, it was a different time. But also, I think the innuendo was probably okay, especially in a more mature title anyway, right? I think that some of the big key things is, you know, sex and nudity are some of the big no-nos still. But even back then, it was not looked well.
Well, and half the game was a radio drama, effectively, as well. And so that meant a lot of work on Konami US's side, I'm sure, getting David Hayter, like making sure that the performances were top-notch, and that really stood out. But that was very different than anything we'd played before. And that must have been a heavy lift. I mean, it all came together beautifully, but Kojima must have had some high level of trust in your office to get that done properly.
Well, this is again where I'll go back to the unnamed person from Konami Japan. This was his baby for however many months and years that it took to get this stuff done. We did hire a voice director, and I always forget her name, but she had a huge pedigree with like Hanna-Barbera cartoons and all kinds of voiceover work, and she was fantastic, a true professional in the voiceover space. So she was in the studio. The gentleman I was talking about earlier was in the studio as well, acting as the voice director, but also he was the one that wrote the script for the US, right? So he was there to help make sure that all of the context was correct for David Hayter and for the other actors that were there playing against him, because we would do for a lot of the cutscene work, we had David Hayter and the actress that played Meryl in the studio together. So it's a pretty rare thing, at least in my recent experience, of being able to have the actors together to play off of each other in the recording studio like that. The job, it was also done initially as a non-union gig.
Oh, wow.
And everyone in the game is under a pseudonym, except David Hayter, who literally called me. I'll never forget this. He called me and was like, hey, I want my name in the game if I can. And like, I sent an email immediately to Japan and said, hey, can we do this? He's willing to eat it if they wind up getting fine. Oh man, I hope he doesn't hear this.
Oh no, well he's also a Hollywood guy. He's working on like X-Men movies and stuff like that. So
yeah, he's and he was great. Like for me, I was able to go to a couple days of that session in LA, and it was again, it was just, it's one of those things where it's like the coolest thing ever. We're sitting there, have to be super quiet, can't move because the couch will make a noise. David Hayter was like, just in between takes, he's just like riffing and doing Luke Skywalker voices and stuff. And it was great. It was fantastic.
That's so cool. Well, and so then you moved from working at Konami in Illinois to getting this incredible opportunity to work on Star Wars in the Bay Area. Is that right?
Yeah. So the story did start with Konami because we had signed a contract. We had hired LucasArts to do a couple games for us when I was at Konami. First one being Zombies Ate My Neighbors.
Oh, I love that game. I love that game.
That game was awesome. So much fun.
So that was initially was called just Monsters, and then came out as Zombies Ate My Neighbors. And then we did another game with that same team, led by, I'm just going to say their names, led by Mike Ebert and Dean Sharp. And that was Metal Warriors.
Okay.
Which was kind of it wasn't an official sequel to Cybernator, but it had a lot of Cybernator influence. And from my contribution to those games and working with those guys, after Konami had moved to California, so Konami moved headquarters from the Chicago area to California, and I was one of like three or four people that actually went through that contact. I got a call one day from Mike Ebert saying, hey, we need some help on Phantom Menace.
Oh,
what do you think? I'm like, hell yeah, let's do this. So, you know, that was at the end of 98. So it was basically Metal Gear had shipped. We were just kind of wrapping up all the stuff we were doing on Silent Hill. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this. This is kind of a dream.
And some stage setting. At that time, Phantom Menace looked like the coolest thing in the world. I remember going to see Meet Joe Black, not because I gave a shit about the new Brad Pitt movie, but because they had the trailer for Phantom Menace. I saw The Waterboy for the same reason, right? So that's how I was making my movie decisions back then, just if I could see that trailer again. And I remember it was so popular that they'd play it at the start and at the end of movies sometimes. And that trailer, you got to give it credit. It made it look like this thing was going to be the best movie ever made. And I don't think we've ever seen a more hyped movie in our life than Phantom Menace, right? Can you even think about one that got people more excited? That 16-year gap, right?
Yeah.
So you must have, at least at the time, been in a position to think that you were going to work on like one of the best, most exciting movie brands of all time.
Yeah, I mean, it was, again, it was very much a like, oh my gosh, I have a chance to work on this, like this secret Star Wars thing, and it's going to be the biggest thing ever. And, you know, I'm going to get a chance to go work at LucasArts, like LucasArts. Oh, and then by the way, you're going to work on The Phantom Menace, the new Star Wars game. It's like, okay. It was very difficult to contain myself. I am not lying at all. The night or two nights before my interview, I drove up to Lucas Valley Drive because I lived in Redwood Shores, or I drove up there because I'm like, I don't know where it's at. I don't want to be late. This is before we had maps on our phones, everyone. So I'm like, I had to drive up there, and I found where the exit was and found where the parking lot was. I'm like, okay, that's the building. That's where I got to be, you know, and like, you know, then had my interviews and was driving home. I got home from the interview and I was like, I bombed it. This isn't going to work. Got home from the interview and I had a message on my answering machine at home. Again, didn't have cell phones. And it was, they were offering me the position. And I think I jumped up and hit the ceiling at that point. So that's
certainly walking on clouds.
Oh, yeah.
My goodness. It was crazy.
And then you got to see the movie before anyone else did, right?
Yeah, so fast forward a few weeks, and I start at Lucas on my first day, did my orientation, and I was like meeting with my boss, and she goes, "Hey, I've arranged for you to go up to Skywalker Ranch." Okay, again, just imagine like all of these things hitting, and like, oh, okay, to see a rough cut of the movie because, you know, that's, you're working on that game, so you need to see what's going on.
Where was LucasArts compared to the ranch in terms of like geographically speaking?
Yeah, so Lucas Valley Road is the exit for both, right?
Okay.
LucasArts was literally right off of the exit at Los Gamos.
Gotcha.
So, but then it was about a
15, not the long meander to the ranch.
Yeah, it's about a 15-minute drive from there to get to the ranch. Yeah, I mean, it was just surreal, right? You know, I'm driving down Lucas Valley Road. It's this crazy winding road. And then there's this little entrance that's kind of hidden. You'd miss it if you weren't paying attention. And pull in, and there's a box, and it's like, "Hi, I'm Mike Gallo. I'm here for this. I need to see this person." And they're like, buzz me in, drive in. Then there's another kiosk of the person checking you in. It's like, okay. And then I drive a little bit. And it's like, oh, there's the Skywalker Fire Department. That's so cool. And then drive is like, oh, it's the Lucas Ranch softball field. And, seeing it's like, oh, there's a building over there. I didn't know. Oh, that's the archive building, which I found out later. And, oh, that's Skywalker Sound right there. You know, so, and then, oh, there's.
But it's really, it literally is a ranch, right? It's very spread out. Yeah. It could be like on a Napa estate or something.
Yeah,
it's
very, for sure. I mean, in front of the Skywalker Sound building, there was a vineyard, 10 rows of grapevines. I don't know how much their yield was. I'm sure it wasn't much, but that they grew some grapes there and made wine.
It does not seem or feel like a place that's the cultural center of the universe for some people. Yeah. It's a very, very surreal experience.
It is quite surreal. Yes. So then I went to this particular building in the back behind the rant. I can't remember whatever it was called behind the main building, and met up with my contact, and he's like, okay. He goes, hey, he's like, we're going to, it's on VHS. We're going to wheel you into this office and you could sit here. Oh, by the way, this is Howard Rothman's office. He's not here today, so you can sit in here. So if you know who Howard Rothman is, he was like the VP of Lucasfilm marketing for years and years. But I go in there and I have those carts from high school, the big TV cart,
AV carts.
20-inch monitor on the top and a couple of VHS players on the bottom. And I got two videotapes because the cut was like 3.5 hours at that point or something. I was allowed to take notes, could take copious notes, whatever. The movie was unlike, I've seen rough cuts before. I had seen rough cuts before at that point because we had worked on a number of things at Konami. Batman is one of the ones that comes to mind. Like, I'd seen rough cuts of some of these movies before they were available. This was unlike anything I've ever seen because it was a lot of animatics in place where unfinished visual effects shots were. It was, a matte painting that was not finished. So it was just a pencil sketch with like a tiny little scene of live action work put in there. You really couldn't see what was going on. So there was a lot of unfinished stuff. All of the voice, all of the dialogue was stuff that was recorded on set. So none of it was mixed. There was virtually no sound effects, nothing like that. The main things that were furthest along and what I saw were Jar Jar and Watto. Because both of those, they had, a ton of animation work to do and, all the lip sync work to make sure that their dialogue matched up. So a lot of that was much, much further along. Like, just as an example, all the Nemoidians at the beginning was all dialogue that was recorded on set. So you're getting whoever was in the costumes, you're hearing their voices, and you could hear all the mechanics coming through from the prosthetic head with the mouth and eye and everything else moving. So you could hear like all of this other noise.
They're flapping, the flapping mouths.
Yeah. So it was very distracting. It was a very rough cut. And I remember finishing that session, watching 3.5 hours of rough cut and driving home. And I did have a cell phone at that point. It was, just a flip phone. I actually called one of my best friends back in Chicago. And I was like, I've made a terrible mistake. and the contrast in my mood and just my mental state from that drive up to the ranch and the drive back is unlike anything I've ever experienced. I was just like, oh my gosh, I don't even know what I saw. Like, I don't know how this made sense. And because a lot of the emphasis in that rough cut was just on the stuff that needed to be finished because of all of the other visual effects and animation deadlines, it was all the stuff that was kind of held up as the most critical and some of the stuff that people didn't enjoy in that film. It was a very interesting day.
You learned before anyone else that this movie was going to be disappointing.
You know, the thing is, Ethan, we've talked a lot about this stuff.
I know.
The thing that I've learned, part of this comes with just getting older and whatever wisdom I've been able to gain in my time, is there are people that grew up with that Star Wars and love it.
Yes.
I've had to realize that it's okay. That's fine. Like, I love Star Wars. I still love Star Wars. And, you know, I'm not going to rewatch those movies. I'll rewatch the films that I grew up with, where other people would much rather rewatch those movies.
Yep.
Everything positive and negative that can be said has been said about Star Wars and those films in particular, and, you know, the prequel trilogy and all that stuff.
Well, I took both my kids to the 25th anniversary reissue. 25 years, by the way. That's mind-blowing unto itself. My kids asked me what I thought of the movie while we walked out, and I said, you know, I think this is the worst movie I've ever seen 7 times in the theaters. And so...
I went and saw it as well on the 25th anniversary.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, really? Wow, you guys are stronger than I. My initial reaction was to episode 1 was it ruined my childhood. I have since adopted more of the viewpoint that you have, Mike, in that it's not for me. And Star Wars is bigger than me and appeals to so many different demographics, you know, age-wise. Yeah. You know, there's people who love Jar Jar, and to me, he is probably the least likable aspect of that series, I guess. Again, it's not for me. And I still love Star Wars. I still think they've done some pretty interesting things over the years. And it's pretty amazing that you were able to be there and persist through it to see some more interesting projects.
Mike, I was just going to say, you had your own Star Wars redemption arc, because I know that you ultimately got to work on Knights of the Old Republic, which, to my taste, is the best Star Wars we had had since 1980.
Yeah, hey, thanks for that. I mean, it definitely, man, there's a lot there too. That was one of the other really crazy experiences at Lucas, because, you know, initially that game was meant to be, they were talking about making it kind of like Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance. So like a isometric action.
Like Diablo.
Action RPG. Yeah. And frankly, there's still space for that Star Wars game. I really wish that would happen. But at the time, that was the original thinking of that. But there was always, it was always meant to be set during that period of time. Like Age of the Jedi was some of the initial inspiration for that.
The writing was so good, though. The gameplay was fantastic as an RPG, but the writing, the big twist, was fantastic. The droids calling us like meatbags and stuff. It's just like there's so much that sticks with you.
A lot of this has been said elsewhere, right? But like some of that stuff like just came about because, you know, it was like meatbag. I don't think that HK-47 was meant to be that much of a adversarial companion. Like he was not meant to be like that initially. And I think a lot of those things kind of happened early on, but as it went on, people were like, okay, you know what? This actually works. I think some of that stuff might have even come after some of the VO was recorded, where it was like, oh, this is a different take than we thought, even based on the director's notes that we had and everything. And the team was like, no, this actually works. This works really well. I mean, one of my favorite stories about the VO on that game is the Ed Asner story. Is we had a character, the director note was, this guy should sound like Ed Asner. And there was an actor that I think was, I can't remember if this actor actually did any of the VO on the game or not, but he saw this character in the director's note, and he's like, he goes, I can't do Ed Asner. He's like, but he's my neighbor. Let me give him a call and see if he's interested. And that is literally how it went down.
Like, that's awesome.
That's amazing.
He gave him a call, and it was like around Christmas time, and he was out Christmas shopping with his family and his granddaughter and stuff. And on the way home, stopped at the studio, came in, they did a quick contract, and he did his read sight unseen. Like, he had never seen the script until walking in the studio.
What a pro.
And then just nailed it and was like, hey, see you guys later. I don't even think we ever brought him back in for retakes. I think that was the one and done.
It adds so much color to the game, too. It's so good. That's great.
It was great.
Well, and I remember back then, the one thing with RPGs is they were the longest types of games you could play. And so if something happened to that save, it could be devastating. Unless you happen to be famous.
Yeah. So this is the QA saving the day Tobey Maguire story. I was taking a break. So we had shipped, and I was on PTO, and got a call from my boss, and he's like, hey, I have a weird thing for you. I'm like, well, what's up? He's like, well, he goes, I got word through like Hollywood agents or whatever that Tobey Maguire is a big fan of the game, and he was playing KOTOR and loved it and had a character that was near, you know, max level, whatever it might be, but somehow his save game got deleted, and they've asked if we could help them with that. And I was like, I'm like, man, you know, the only way we could do it is to literally rebuild it by playing through the game again and getting to that point. I'm like, the key thing would be we'd have to try to make some of those same choices, you know, some of those key moments where there were choices that had consequence in the game. And so we worked with the QA team and arranged a phone call with the agent, myself, our QA person, and Tobey Maguire, so that we could ask him some questions about what he had done in the game. So, I mean, this is this surreal phone call of like, hey, this is Toby. Let's talk. Okay, so what did you do at this point? Do you remember how you handled this dialogue choice? Were you more on the light side or dark side? Like, you know, all of these questions that we were asking him to kind of get an idea. And we literally had to play through on an Xbox, save the game there, because you couldn't transfer files. You could, but it wasn't easy or user-friendly at all, or even endorsed by Microsoft. And we played through it, got to that point in the game, saved it off, and then shipped him an Xbox.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
So that he could pick up the game kind of where he left off without having to spend the 8 or 10 hours or whatever it was to get there.
Well, and if this had been Xbox 360 era, you'd at least have some telemetry in the form of achievements or something you could track to, but you didn't even have that.
Yeah, we had nothing. There was really nothing. It was literally fully manual, figuring out what he had done and then rebuilding it through a gameplay.
The benefits of being Spider-Man.
Yes, for sure. And the first time I heard this story, it came from the fact that I went into Mike's office and we were just bullshitting as we were prone to do. And I saw this beautiful framed poster from the Spider-Man movie signed by Tobey Maguire. I'm like, how the hell did you get that? Well, there you go.
Yeah, I got that poster, and he had sent over almost the next week, I think. He had sent over like this big basket of cookies and candy and stuff, and just kind of as a thank you for helping. And
it's nice that he was appreciative.
Oh, yeah. Nothing in that very short interaction, nothing but good things. And the QA guys were super stoked to eat all that stuff. It was a good moment. It's one of those stories that'll stick around for a while.
Fantastic.
That is absolutely fantastic, yeah. I only once saw him at the launch party that Nintendo threw for the GameCube. He was there with Kirsten Dunst, and a bunch of bodyguards, like trying all the new GameCube games. It was kind of neat to just be within a few feet of Spider-Man. Yeah, he's definitely a gamer. That same party, by the way, Leonardo DiCaprio was there, and I remember like watching him getting the walkthrough on Pikmin and how to play that. Thought that was kind of neat to see. Celebrities love games as much as anyone else.
Here I got a good celebrity story. I don't know if I ever told this story to anybody, but this was CES 3DO era. We were in the 3DO booth, and I was sitting there like playing a game, looking up at the monitor, playing, doing, I can't remember what game it was, and you know, just kind of doing my thing, whatever. And my buddy is trying to get my attention. I'm like, I'm busy. I'm checking this out. Give me a second. He's like, no. He's like, keeps trying to like get my attention. And finally I died or whatever. And I'm like, what's going on? Like, what's so important? He goes, dude, Steven Spielberg was playing a game right behind you. He's like, you were literally inches away from Steven Spielberg while he was playing a game, checking out some 3DO thing. I'm like, damn it.
That's awesome. I bet he was wearing a ball cap and all of that.
I never even saw him. And I was literally standing back to back with the guy. That's my brush with Steven Spielberg fame, right? I was like, man. The
cinematic greatness.
That is so cool. So then did you go from Lucas to Sega? Was that the next step?
Yeah. Lucas ended at the very end of 2005. And then I started at Sega. Yeah, I started at Sega at the end of 2005, like the week before Christmas.
Okay.
Yeah.
And which titles did you work on there? I know, but I'm just prompting for the audience here.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I started off, the first thing that I worked on was Full Auto 2.
Yes.
I loved Full Auto. That was so much fun. I missed the vehicular combat genre, and also like the games like Burnout, where you can just kind of drive around and trash cars, trash each other. I miss those kind of driving games.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What was that Burnout, the 360 era Burnout that had, it was the first one that they did where they had the mode where you just could smash into an intersection to try to do as much damage as possible. I can't remember.
Oh, what it was called. Was it Burnout Paradise or Burnout 3 Takedown?
I think it was Burnout Takedown. 3.
Yeah.
Takedown sounds familiar.
Yeah,
that was my favorite. It was just so much fun just to see how much carnage you can rack up. It's just so cool.
Yeah, it was so great. Yeah, so Full Auto 2, and then...
Which was a PlayStation 3 launch title, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was. That was a challenge. One of the cool things was showing that game off at E3 multiplayer. I think it was one of the very few games that had multiplayer on display and playable at E3 that year. So that was pretty fun. And then, gosh, there was a lot of things that I was involved in. Not many of them shipped. Samba de Amigo on the Wii, I worked with folks on that. Obviously, Aliens Colonial Marines, the Aliens RPG.
The Obsidian one that wasn't to be, right? Yeah.
Yep.
We can say that it was publicly announced. Yeah.
Yes. I have many, many comments about all of these things that I'm not sure that I should say.
Yeah. Talented guys, though, the Obsidian team. I wish it had come out because it had some really, really cool ideas. But
oh, my gosh. I loved working with the Obsidian team, and I still chat with them occasionally. So it's been many, many years since I last worked on something in the industry with that team. But I love those guys.
We did get Alpha Protocol out, which if I remember was Obsidian, right? Yeah, and that was a very clever game as well.
Yeah, Alpha Protocol, I think maybe a little bit ahead of its time in some ways.
Yeah, definitely. That's the view I have of it.
Yeah, a lot of hurdles to get over to make that thing work, but there were some moments in it that were really great.
Yep.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I think back to the Sega times, I'm like, man, I didn't ship too much there.
But that was just the nature of AAA at the time. There were a lot of places where they'd work for years on a game and it just wouldn't hit the finish line.
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely a rocky time. It was definitely one of the rockiest times of my career was that 3-year stretch.
Yeah, and maybe sometimes games that did hit the finish line shouldn't have. I mean, that happens too.
Sure. I actually was going through games in my collection of games here and came across my copies of Samba de Amigo that are still sealed.
Yeah, and that game is great. That's a fun one. I still have the Wii Maraca controllers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The only thing I can say, the best thing that I contributed to that game was fighting in meetings to get some additional budget to sign music for it. And my one contribution to the music list was Jump in the Line.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah.
That was about it. So.
And so, Mike, after Sega, am I remembering correctly that you went to Edge of Reality? Was that right? Or
yeah, I went to go work there on what was initially pitched to me as an EA project, and found out that it was a 360 and PS3 port of The Sims.
Interesting. Okay.
That was an incredible challenge from a technical standpoint. Very, very difficult project just to get that thing to work. So this is a Sims 3 on PC. You were fully 3D. You were in the city. You could go wherever you wanted in the city and go visit your Sims and have all these interactions in real time. On console, we're talking 360 and PS3 era, you've got the worst of both worlds. So you had the PS3, which had split memory configuration, and then you had the Xbox that you had to deal with a hard drive or potentially no hard drive. So you had to, you know, it had to be built to account for all of those things. And I mean, of course, everyone is dealing with those challenges on those consoles at the time, but a PC port and a PC game of that magnitude and the way that thing was authored was a significant technical hurdle.
I would imagine there'd also be kind of UI user experience challenges people used to playing on. I mean, especially the Sims title on mouse and keyboard, and trying to translate that to controllers must have been a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah, 100%. Like the UI development and the user experience and all that stuff was the team that I was running. Mm. So we had 27 people total.
Wow.
Just doing that. I mean, the whole game is UI in a lot of senses, right?
Like that is the game.
Yeah.
You know, UI is everything for that. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was actually one of the, I remember being asked that question in the interview, you know, just like, oh, well, what would you think about, you know, a challenge to bring a Sims game over to a console? And I think immediately it was UI and how you're interacting with things, and then just rebuilt, like, how do you do this on controller? So everything had to be solved from the bottom up. Again, it was definitely a challenge. The great thing about that game, that project, it's one of the very few times that I've worked in the industry where I've been able to work on a direct sequel almost immediately. So we did The Sims 3, and then we did The Sims 3 Pets. And it's one of those things where if you haven't had the chance to do it in the industry, haven't had a chance to work on that project where you get a sequel or whatever, it's amazing because a lot of the big problems were solved. Now we were figuring out cool new things that we could do and new features that we could add in and all this other stuff that we couldn't even think about on the first project because everything was just focused on getting it squeezed into those parameters and working and being stable and being able to, you know, play it. We had, this is where like this, like a lot of this just crazy game development stuff comes into play. On the PlayStation 3, you could only play Sims 3 for like 3 hours. And after 3 hours, if you hit a load or saved, it was almost inevitable the game was going to crash.
Oh, I remember Skyrim had the same problems with that. Yeah.
Was it a memory leak or?
It was because of the way, I'm not sure if it was a memory leak or if it was just the way memory was handled. And, you know, just very difficult to clean up memory as you're playing through that thing. And there's so many different parameters and flags that are set as you're making every single decision that happens. We knew that we had a limit where it would crash, and that was we basically negotiated with Sony. We didn't, but the publisher was, to like, if we can get it stable to this degree, is this going to pass? We were able to increase that pretty significantly in the next game, and the next game was far more complicated because we had pets. But, you know, there was, again, just getting through it once and then being able to kind of take a step back and refactor some of the low-hanging fruit you know, and making things better and more memory efficient and all this other stuff, and then being able to add some stuff in. It's a crazy experience because neither of those games did very well, but there was a ton of learning and the camaraderie on the team. Pretty much everybody knew the challenges that we had, and we just worked through it. It was kind of bonkers.
Mike, I also remember you worked on Star Wars Uprising, right?
Yeah. So, and that was after, so after Edge of Reality, I went to Kabam and went back to the Bay Area. You know, for me, I was really taking this time in my career to like, okay, I've been doing a lot of this stuff for a long time. I feel like I need some challenges and to learn some things. That was one of the reasons why Edge was a great place for me, because it was an independent developer. You know, I'm like, let's go experience that. After being there for a few years and working on a few games, I'm like, mobile, Facebook games, like those are up and coming. Let's go get some experience doing that.
Just to add to this, the reason I brought up Star Wars Uprising, Mike, was that over at the Sega Networks office where Chris and I were, we'd have a small group of people playing that game during lunchtime. Mm. And we're really enjoying the kind of Diablo-type experience. And I remember one of the kind of harder learnings for me was that your team was doing for mobile games exactly the stuff that I wanted to really enjoy mobile more, but turned out to be what most people didn't want, it seemed, which was like the action gameplay.
Right, right. Star Wars Uprising was built on the tech and the engine that was built for Spirit Lords.
Yeah, another game I liked. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a pretty fun game. Yeah.
A lot of the core of that was there. The thing that for me that was interesting about Uprising was it's such a bummer that when we launched, we knew that we had a content issue terms of like what we could launch with and then what we could bring, you know, every week through that first 6 month period. So we had to basically cut up a lot of the game to be able to finish and polish what we could launch with, but then also make sure that we had a good cadence of content going forward. And it was story content. Like this was all story beats because we did have Princess Leia in our game. I don't think anybody ever saw that cutscene or that dialogue with her, which is unfortunate because there were some kind of cool little tie-ins to, you know, what had happened in the films. And then, you know, we had the big kind of meta game with sector battles where there would be a Star Destroyer would come in and like take over a planet, and the community would have to work to fight them off and drive them out and stuff like that. So there was a lot of really cool little things like that that I don't think we're able to fully realize in that game. And the real tragedy of all of it is now no one can. It's gone.
Well, whereas KOTOR people can come back to and play and enjoy. Yeah. Yeah, you kind of lose this thing, which had, I do remember the Leia stuff. I don't know if I got to it myself or if I saw it on YouTube. It's been more than 10 years, right?
Yeah.
I do know that I saw it. And unfortunately, that's the only way you can see it now is if someone grabbed it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I looked around a little bit, but I'm sure that there are people that did like a full capture of some of that stuff. But my goodness. Yeah, it's just kind of gone. And we did VO work for, like, there was a lot of stuff in there that I don't think everyone at the time was doing. There were a few games that were doing it, but just having some of that dialogue was kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And also painful, but kind of amazing to have in a mobile game, so.
Well, getting experience with that live service type of content, especially the story-driven stuff, did help you, I'm sure, prepare for other things you did down the line in your career.
Just prior to Star Wars Uprising, I was working on Realm of the Mad God.
Right, yeah.
Realm of the Mad God was a kind of a crash course in some of that, like everything from that era. Like the odds of getting rare items in the game and buying dungeon keys and just, you know, all of that sort of thing.
It's kind of a crash course in economics in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah. We only had 6 people on that team.
Yeah.
So everyone contributed. And what I mean by everyone contributed, like I did animation for that game.
Oh, wow.
I did dungeon content for that game.
Nice.
So, I mean, it was cool. I learned a lot and stress out a lot, but it was kind of like the little game that could. Nobody believed that we could do anything because the team had been like 30 or 40 people prior to some round of layoffs. And then
was that when it, because it was at Kabam, right? But yeah. But it existed before Kabam, if I remember correctly.
It existed before Kabam as it was kind of like a, I think it was a project that was entered in like some independent game dev thing that they won. And then Kabam somehow acquired it or bought the rights to it or something like that. Because the original folks that worked on it were not involved with basically any of it at Kabam.
Yeah.
But yeah, Kabam took it over and ran it for, you know, I think Realm is still going, actually. I think someone else bought it from Kabam after that time was done.
That was going to be my next question. And it is a shame when things are ephemeral and they go away, but it's also amazing to see which games have lasted now a decade plus. EA's Simpsons Tapped Out, Aaron Loeb just had a report saying that it was closing.
R.I.P.
Yeah, but that game lasted for 10 years.
12 years.
There you go. Yeah. Crazy.
And I played it. I played it for probably at least half that time. I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It was fun.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. I remember hearing about it. I'm not sure I ever played it, but I was shocked to hear that it was still going. Like, I didn't know. I didn't know it was still a thing.
It's funny. I saw the news that it was closing down, and I said, I haven't played this in a long time. Maybe I'll just update my client and check it out just for a little while before they shut it down. And I think it's been so long since I updated, it's just immediate server error. So I just had to sadly delete it from my phone. It was pretty sad. I would have liked to have gazed at my Springfield one last time, but alas.
Yep, yep.
Ethan, we haven't talked about some of this in quite a long time. Like, my main game for the last 7 years has been Destiny.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So Destiny 2 has been kind of the main go-to thing. Mm-hmm. And obviously Destiny and Realm have that little connection. I want to say one of the Destiny guys was one of the original guys that did Realm.
That's fascinating. I had no idea about that.
Well, if you remember in Realm of the Mad God, the main bad guy is Oryx.
I never put that together.
Also the main bad guy in Destiny, or one of the main bad guys in Destiny.
I bet you... Almost nobody who listens to this will have made that connection before. That's super interesting.
I mean, it might just be a weird... I'm pretty sure we had talked about this when I was there, that it was that one of the Destiny guys, one of the guys that eventually went to work on Destiny and Destiny 2, was one of the guys that did Realm.
That makes perfect sense, yeah.
I don't want to say names because I don't know for sure if it's that person. You want to talk about like my experience working on games and working on games as a service and working on this stuff and then playing arguably one of the most successful ones and one of the longest running ones right now and all of the ups and downs of that game.
Well, I'm curious, Mike, did you do Crucible much or was it almost all PvE for you?
I did probably more PvP than I did PvE.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Still terrible.
But it's just so cool that that game could support all of that. Think about how complex that is, right?
I have often had this discussion when people that I'm, you know, I would join a Destiny clan and have a lot of friends. It's very strange. My Destiny clan is quite a mix of people. Only a couple of us work in the games industry. Almost everyone else in our clan is some form of ex-military.
Wow.
Interesting.
Like, I'm talking like guys that flew A-10s, guys that flew Ospreys. We have a fighter pilot in our clan. Like, it's crazy. And then, you know, us game guys, we're like, you guys are so cool. And they're like, you work in games? That's awesome. I'm like... Like, one of the things we would talk about some of the technical issues and some of the problems. I'm like, man, you know what's still amazing to me? I can open my character while I'm in a load screen and I can change everything on my character.
And you can appreciate how hard that is. People take it for granted, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, once they solve that problem, It's all gravy, right? But that's a difficult problem to solve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and thinking about like stuff like that is just kind of mind-blowing to me. The seamless way that they handle first person to third person stuff in that game. I can't think of another game that does it as well as Destiny does.
The vision and the understanding of having a game that just continues to evolve, because remember the contract that they had with Activision was requiring a Destiny 3.
Yep. Yep.
And they understood that that's not what you should do.
Yeah, I mean, the landscape changed markedly, right? So I think everyone kind of realized that the games as platform thing is it's wiser to put the investment in into the ongoing concern.
It's infinitely fascinating for me from all of the game development stuff, right? Game development, publishing, all of those things, right? There's so much that can be talked about there. And then, of course, the game itself, the lore, the history, all of that stuff. Like, it's a shame to me that the game is just, it's in a bad place at the moment, I think.
Yeah. Well, they lost half their staff now, right?
Well, I think part of it is that, of course, there's all kinds of things that we can get into there, but the game itself, it really is a very good parallel to, you know, Marvel, the Marvel Cinematic Universe and Infinity War and Endgame. Mm-hmm. And like going, okay, what do we do after Endgame? And I mean, I think they've even mentioned those parallels, but Marvel had a hard time finding their feet after Endgame.
Yeah.
Some of it was due to the pandemic, but some of it was just like, who's going to be the big bad and how are we going to make this compelling and all this other stuff?
Yeah.
I feel the same.
Yeah. I feel like they're still trying to find their feet, to be honest, but.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I have hope. I have hope that they'll be back.
The TV stuff's been pretty interesting, but that's another conversation. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, I'm getting off.
Hard to keep these things going for a decade plus, and impressive when companies are able to do it, whether it's in games or film.
100%.
They're keeping the attention of this audience that's very hungry for content. Like, that's one thing, is it's like that Destiny content, the most core people burn right through those new updates. And that's very hard to balance, I would imagine, with the people who, you know, love the game, but can only play for a couple of hours a week.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I cannot imagine the cadence and the pressure and the stress to deliver that stuff.
The treadmill.
Yeah, it's. I mean, from a player standpoint, I've been kind of busy doing some other things, so I've put games down for a little bit here as I've been relocating my life. So.
It's been a pretty amazing conversation. The stories are great. It's always great to catch up with you. And I think it would be fun to have you back and maybe some other Destiny players. And you guys can take Ethan and I on a tour of Destiny.
I would absolutely love that. Like, I would absolutely love that.
Yeah, I'd happily prep by just playing a few hours and getting my feet wet. And that would be fun to talk about.
Yeah. It would be fun. Mike, as always, a pleasure to see you. Really appreciate your insights and taking the time to chat with us.
Yeah, awesome. It was great. It's always good to catch up and talk about some stuff that we all love. We can save all the stuff that we don't love about it for later.
Yep. Yeah, that's what it's all about. Absolutely.
Cool. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and send us your questions, and we'll do our best to answer them. Thanks, everyone.